Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we, of course, discuss UFOs and the Paranormal, and we have on exciting new guests. And tonight, I'm very proud of our guest tonight, who is actually Stanton Friedman. Now, I don't know how many of you know Stanton Friedman, but you'd have to be living under a rock if you haven't heard of him, because he's probably the foremost UFO researcher in the United States, if not the world. He's been actually in UFO research since 1967 and has lectured at more than 600 colleges and 100 professional groups across the United States and the world. He's a pioneering investigator to the Roswell UFO crash, the author of Crash at Corona and Top Secret Magic, and is also the co-author of the brand new book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which he co-wrote with Kathleen Martin, the niece of Betty Hill, actually, who was our guest last week. And this book has just been released by New Page Books. And if any of you want to visit Stanton's website, it's his name, www.stantonfriedman.com. I visited it. There's a lot of very interesting things there. Stanton, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's an honor to have you.
My pleasure to be here.
So, wow, you've been in this for the longest time. Let me see, I was in diapers when you were doing this. My God.
Hey, I actually started in ufology. I read my first book in 1958. Took me 9 years to get around to giving my first lecture, you understand.
I can imagine, yes. I mean, it was an interesting story how you got involved in this. I mean, you started out pretty much, you know, a disinterested skeptic, I guess. Would that be the right word?
I guess that's the way to put it. I needed another book, and books I was ordering, there was a report on unidentified flying objects by Captain Edward Ruppelt, Air Force. I was working on an Air Force program co-sponsored with the Atomic Energy Commission at the General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, and the book was marked down from $2.95 to a buck. How could I go wrong? That's what shipping would have been if I hadn't ordered the book. So I read the book. It intrigued me but didn't convince me. I read 15 more books. I found a copy of Project Blue Book Special Report 14 at the University of California, Berkeley Library. That shocked me because there was the Secretary of the Air Force lying through his teeth to the American public in the press release. That bothered me since I was accustomed to working under security, but hey, lying is something else. And so it took me a while. I joined APRO and NICAP. And I got to know Frank Edwards, and his book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business, pushed me in the direction of speaking out. I mean, I was working on government programs under security, and I wanted to be careful what I said. I didn't want to lose my job and all the rest of that.
Well, didn't you actually get to meet, like, one of the guys involved in Project Blue Book as well? Robert.
Well, I visited Project Blue Book several times. It happened, I was working at Aerojet General Nucleonics in California, in the Bay Area, and I was working on a contract analysis and evaluation of fast and intermediate reactors for space vehicle applications. The word that's left out is Soviet, trying to figure out what Russian capabilities were. This is in the early 60s.
Right.
And the contracting office was the Foreign Technology Division of the Air Force, which is where Project Blue Book was at the time. And I would go back there every month or two, and I'd stop by doing my job and also talking to Colonel Friend, who was the Air Force Project Blue Book guy. So, yeah, I got to know the Blue Book people, and it was government data, really, that convinced me. And then the government lies on top of it, and like I said, I worked under security, so I do know something about how security operates. I've been to 20 document archives. I also know something about far-out technology, having worked not only on nuclear airplanes at GE, but at Westinghouse on nuclear rockets, at Aerojet General on fusion rockets, and several other places and other compact nuclear reactor development programs. My specialty was canceled government-sponsored research program.
Well, you're one of the first real scientists who started looking into this phenomenon, I think, and took it seriously.
Well, yeah, and I was able to provide congressional testimony at the hearing for the hearings in 1968, and I've been going strong ever since. Matter of fact, I just got a contract for another book, Flying Saucers and Science, and I've got to work real hard to get it done by the end of the year because I got a lot going on.
Well, yeah, you just had a. I should congratulate you for having a day named after you.
Yeah, last Monday, August 27th, was Stanton Friedman Day in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. It's the capital of the province of New Brunswick, and they appreciate all I do to tell the world about Fredericton. I've been here 27 years. The previous 27, I lived in 7 different states, but we're stayed put here, and... let me correct one rumor that's been going around, and I can't seem to squash it. Oh, the FBI chased Friedman out of the United States. That's what happened. Nonsense. My wife is from New Brunswick. She's one of 9 siblings. 6 of them live right here in Fredericton. Her parents were alive when we moved here. Got a ton of family around here, and it's a great place to live. The other rumor, incidentally, was I came here for the free medical care. Well, I haven't spent an overnight in a hospital since I was born, and that was a lot of years ago. I haven't done much about that either.
Well, have you ever had any type of government interference with your research?
Not that I know of. You know, in a tricky sort of way, the late Philip Klass, Mr. Nasty Noisy Negativist himself, did write a letter to the Canadian government, which I didn't hear about until a couple of years ago, but he wrote it way back a few weeks before I moved to Canada, warning them that I was coming here and I would talk about a cosmic Watergate and embarrass them and blah, blah, blah. But theoretically, he didn't work for the government, so we can't blame that on him. No, people have asked me, I've had, every once in a while somebody says, how come you're still alive, Stan? That I can't spend my life worrying, looking over my shoulder. I am very open. I've never had an unlisted phone number. I have a live answering service that tells people where I will be when. That trip from Albuquerque to Roswell is 200 miles, and the last over 100 is nothing, out in the middle of nowhere. Anybody wanted to take me out, they've had plenty of opportunities, so I don't worry about it. Maybe I'm doing exactly what they want done.
Right.
You know, that's my good way of looking at things. Be an optimist. What the heck?
Well, it's good to hear that, I guess.
I don't want to worry about that sort of... I've had Air Force colonels sitting next to me at lectures I've given, you know, after dinner talks and things like that, so I can't worry about it.
All right. So the Roswell crash was the first real big, I mean, that's the big case of the whole, I think, the whole world, the biggest case. And that's the one that's going to crack the cover up wide open one day.
Well, one hopes so. And certainly I had no idea when almost 30 years ago I spoke with Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer at the Roswell Army Airfield, the home of the only atomic bombing group in the entire world in 1947. I spoke to him in 1978, and I was people act as if, well, the nasty, noisy negativists act as if all these people came running to Friedman trying to get publicity. Well, that's baloney incorporated. I was referred to him by an old ham radio buddy of his who was the station manager at a TV station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was supposed to do 3 interviews prior to my lecture that night at Louisiana State University, and I did the first 2. The 3rd reporter wasn't around. No cell phones back then, and he, the station manager, is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the people who brought me to the station. And out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he? Oh, he handled wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What?
Yeah.
You know, what do you know about him? Well, he lives over in Houma. I didn't know where Houma, Louisiana was, but he's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to give him a call. Well, then the reporters showed up, so there was a 20-minute window of opportunity. Had a great response that night at the lecture. The next day from the airport, I called information to see if there was a listing for a Jesse Marcel in Houma, and there was. He told me a story, didn't have a date. I tucked it away. A few months later, I'm in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody else asked me, ever hear about a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, tell me more. They told me their story, the Barney Barnett story, about over in the plains of San Agustin, as it turns out, in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have a date either. I shared that with Bill Moore the next day. He was living in Minnesota, and I'd known him when we both lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he had a third story. The key story was an article in Flying Saucer Review, a British publication, still going out there, talking about an English actor named Huey Green, who, there was an article saying he had heard on the radio about a crash flying saucer in New Mexico while driving across the country from L.A. to Philadelphia. And he thought there'd be a big deal when he got to Philadelphia. There wasn't. Now, he could pin down the date because it wasn't a trip you made very often back then, as you can imagine what the roads were like.
Right.
It was early July 47. Bill Moore went to the University of Minnesota Library in Twin Cities and started looking through the media, the periodicals. There was the story. Confirmed what Jesse Marcel had said, gave us a whole bunch more names. In the next 2 years, Bill and I located 62 people in conjunction with Roswell. That's before the first book was published, The Roswell Incident, by Moore and Charles Berlitz. Bill and I did over 90% of the research. Berlitz wrote the book. And we kept up till 1985. We had 92 people. I instigated the Unsolved Mysteries Program in 1989. That was seen by 28 million people.
Wow.
Brought a lot of witnesses out of the woodwork, so to speak. And then there have been a whole bunch of books since then, including the one by Don Berliner and myself, Crash at Corona, still available, incidentally. And, yeah, Roswell became a very big deal, and I was, of course, at the 60th anniversary celebration last month, and, of course, was there for the 50th and many times since then. But, and, you know, it's clear the Air Force takes Roswell seriously. They've written more about it in these two terrible official reports. Well, I mean, gee whiz, you want an example of nonsense? The Roswell Report, Truth versus Fiction in the New Mexico Desert. The Air Force supplied the fiction. They said they weren't going to write anymore. That was it. That was the Mogul balloon nonsense. Well, of course, a few years later, they wrote a second report, the Roswell Report, Case Closed. Now, this, they provided the fourth explanation for Roswell, and the strangest and most baloneyest, if I can coin a word, of all. This is the crash test dummies nonsense.
Right.
And I say nonsense because two important things. One is none of the crash test dummies were dropped until after 1953. Roswell happened in 1947, so we have time travel for crash test dummies. And secondly, I located the man who was in charge of the program. His picture's in the book. And he pointed out that for the test to be meaningful, ejection seats and that sort of stuff, that's why they were using crash test dummies. You don't want to put your pilots in these things until you're sure they work. The dummies had to be 6 feet tall and 175 pounds. There's a picture of them in the book. And there's no way to morph that into a four-foot-tall guy with a big head and a skinny body. You know, it's typical. The press bought it. What else did the Air Force care about?
Right. I mean, there's just so many witnesses to this incident. It surprises me that major researchers still refuse to accept it and question some of it and are waffling even.
Well, yeah, Roswell has become a focal point for the debunkers, of course. And Mogul, what's wrong with Mogul? Well, they completely ignore the newspapers of July 8, 1947, which say the wreckage was found last week. They grabbed the rancher, fed him a new story, and the next day's paper say, oh, yeah, you know, it was found back in mid-June, which is hardly last week from July 8th. And they fed him a new story, and they want us to believe it. Well, the first explanation was a flying saucer was recovered. I've got headlines from across the country about it. And the second story, oh, it was just a radar reflector weather balloon combination, even though Major Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer, had had a course in radar, which included work with balloons, less than 2 years earlier, mind you.
Right. Well, it's like you wrote the rules of debunking, you know, with the
debunking
of this whole set of rules that they actually go by.
There was much more. Nothing about Mogul fits the description given by the witnesses of what was out there or the people who handled the wreckage. I mean, a balloon is a balloon. These were standard weather balloons, even though some of the TV mockumentaries show huge teardrop-shaped balloons. They weren't used for Mogul at this time. They used standard, you know, the kind that you could buy at a surplus store of weather balloons, a whole string of them, 20 of them, at 20-foot intervals, sometimes 25 balloons. There was nothing that matches the foil that you could fold and fold and fold, and it would unfold on its own, but you couldn't tear.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Well, what do you think of Walter Hout's recent affidavit that he left where he said he saw the bodies?
Yeah, I was the first to find Walter Hout, and I considered him a tower of strength, an honorable man, a very decent individual who was well appreciated in the town of Roswell, got community awards and so forth. The affidavit, which he didn't seem to have written himself as such, he talked to other investigators, Don Schmidt and Tom Carey, over a period of time. It was prepared for his signature, and he did sign it. And I don't know. What I'd like, it's in my gray basket, basically. What I'd like to see, and some of us are hoping to get this maybe, is one of the things he talks about is a meeting at the base on July 8th in the morning where we know Major Marcel was present, where he says that General Roger Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force, the 509th in Roswell, was under Ramey, who was based in Fort Worth. They say that he says that Ramey and Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose, who was his chief of staff, were at that meeting at Roswell the morning of the 8th. Now, we know that they and Major Marcel were back in Fort Worth that afternoon because we have pictures taken in Ramey's office. Now, it's physically possible, of course, that they were there and went back. But I'd like to see a flight log, for example, to show that indeed Ramey and Dubose, they were both still flying, and Ramey had his own airplane. Many of the generals did a B-17. A lot of them left over from the war, as you can imagine, because they were superseded by the B-29. I'd like to see some evidence that they had indeed made that trip. And one of the things is that not only did Jesse Marcel never say that he knew about bodies to either his son or to me or anybody else, as far as I know, but I had located Colonel Dubose. He was in his mid-80s. And in our last conversation, I met with him twice in person. There's a video, Recollections of Roswell, which has his testimony on it, filmed much, much, much later, of course. And the last thing he said to me was, "Stan, I like what you're doing. If I remember anything more, I'll let you know. What can they do to me now?" You know, by the time he was that age, he wasn't worried about that.
Right.
Now, I would have thought that he would have said something about that meeting. And so I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm certainly not calling Walter a liar, because I don't consider him a liar. But he was old at that time. He was in his 80s. He had done hundreds of interviews. And I've seen one interview that has not been publicly released that where he did say something similar, but he was being browbeaten by the interviewer and may have just agreed to get her off his back. I don't know. So if true, it's extraordinarily important. If not, well, we have to proceed without it, so to speak. And maybe we leave it in the gray basket. I don't know.
Well, clearly this incident changed a lot of people's lives. Wow.
Well, it didn't change. It changed his, of course, but the statement didn't, since he was dead when it was released.
right. But, I mean, it's the big case. And like I would say the Betty and Barney Hill case, that has to be also one of the biggest cases out there.
Well, I'll tell you, in the last couple months, it came out in early July, just in time for the Roswell event, and I was signing books there. I was next to Jesse Marcel Jr., who has a new book out, The Legacy of Roswell, The Roswell Legacy, by Colonel, Doctor, Pilot, Jesse Marcel Jr. He was called back in to serve in Iraq at age 68, would you believe,
wow.
And put in 225 flight hours, combat flying hours, besides being a medical doctor, a flight surgeon, great guy. Anyway, at Roswell, I found out, because I was signing copies of the book, Captured, I found out that that was the story that got an awful lot of people interested in UFOs. When it came out in Look magazine in 1966, and John Fuller's great book, The Interrupted Journey, and just as Ruppelt's book was the first for some of us of a somewhat older generation, if you will, The Interrupted Journey about Betty and Barney Hill was a turning point. The two articles in Look magazine got an awful lot of attention, and I was fortunate, and people say, what the heck are you doing with this book, Stan? You're a Roswell guy. Well, I had met both Betty and Barney back in 1968 in Pittsburgh. Seen Betty many times since Barney died in February of 69. And I was a consultant on the television movie, The UFO Incident, starring James Earl Jones, 1975.
Right. See, that was my first exposure. I saw that. I mean, it was a good show. I didn't really think it was real, even though they probably said so on the...
It was a fine job. I was pleased at how well they did, and you have to laugh at this. Universal Studios, I was living in Southern California at the time, Universal Studios got my name as a possible consultant from the United States Air Force.
Oh, is that right?
It's supposed to refer him to a local scientist. Well, I guess the Air Force knew about me, so... But... The story, our book, as you found out from Kathleen last week, has an awful lot of stuff that wasn't in the first book. Kathy has done an enormous amount of analysis. She had all the tapes and the correspondence, and she had access to Betty for the last 10 years of Betty's life. And they talked a great deal about the case, and more important, she found that when you started analyzing the tapes made by Dr. Simon, who was not a ufologist, didn't care about flying saucers, but was a very fine psychiatrist whose job it was to, how shall I put this, take care of things that got in the way of people's lives, post-traumatic stress syndrome, what else can you call it today? Then it was shell shock war veterans. I mean, he worked with thousands, literally, of Army war veterans. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. Sometimes it's a little hard to handle that.
Right, right.
And so he wasn't playing parlor games, and it wasn't one session. Carl Sagan, and, you know, Carl and I were classmates for 3 years at the University of Chicago. Not that he ever bragged about me being his classmate, but anyway. he said in a look in a Parade magazine Sunday supplement article, about which I gave him a very hard time, made it sound like Betty and Barney had one hypnosis session. This is particularly true when he was trying to dismiss the star map work of Marjorie Fish. It wasn't one session. It was months of weekly separate sessions. And Simon asked some of the same questions several different times under different circumstances. Did it? Great job, not of finding out about UFOs, but of finding out what happened to them during the missing 2 hours. And so the story is important, and I deal with the star map work in the story and take on some of the heavy hitting against the nasty, noisy negativists. As you can believe, the debunkers love to attack the Hill case, because if it's legitimate, then forget all the other objections, you know.
Right, right. Well, I mean, clearly it's got an enormous amount of evidence. There were, like, other witnesses to UFOs that night?
Oh, yes, and the military and the radar and the Air Force playing games with the Blue Book files. And
none of that came through in John Fuller's book. It was a completely different experience reading your book, Captured. And finally, you really get the full story behind it. Really,
yeah.
What's really the most famous UFO incident in history. And,
yeah, I mean, it is. And it's the incident that gave a lot of other people the courage to either investigate on the one hand abduction cases or to report their own on the other hand. It wasn't the first abduction. was the first one that was investigated and that we know anything about, a lot about.
Right, and it nearly didn't get any publicity at all, which is amazing.
Yeah, not at the time. Well, as a matter of fact, the Hills weren't seeking publicity.
Right, right.
They did their darnest to keep the story from coming out. They were afraid of losing their jobs. I mean, people forget. Betty was a social worker with the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office, but he also was on the Governor's Civil Rights Commission, very active in the NAACP. It was a mixed marriage. Barney Black, that's why he was played by James Earl Jones in the movie. Betty White. The last thing they needed for all their community activities and everything else was to get publicity about a flying saucer story. Wow. Well, to their astonishment, when the story did come out, in spite of their efforts to keep it from coming out, newspaper articles in the Boston newspaper, they got all kinds of interest and approval from all around the world. What a shock. You know, it's one of the many myths about ufology is that, gee, most people don't believe in UFOs, and Stan, you're the only scientist who believes in UFOs. Both of those are nonsense. The polls have consistently shown, public opinion polls, polls of engineers and scientists, that believers outnumber non-believers, and the greater the education, the more likely to believe in flying saucers. The problem is that most people have been brainwashed into thinking that most other people don't believe in UFOs. I once, in a class of 100 students, I do a lot of classroom visits on campuses and stuff, with 100 students, I said, look, I'd like to get your views on something, but I want them to be yours and not your neighbors here in the class, about 100 students. I'd like you to vote with your eyes closed and just raise your hand as appropriate, and your instructor and I will count the votes. Well, it turns out, to make a very long story short, that 80% of that group thought that most people didn't believe in UFOs. But it further turns out that 80% of that group did believe in UFOs.
Oh, wow, isn't that extraordinary? Well, must be a result of kind of the cover-up or the spin that's been put on this phenomena.
Yeah,
the ridicule factor, right?
Yeah, the laughter curtain is real. And the thing is, if your behavior is determined by your perception of how other people will respond, regardless of how accurate your perception is, then people don't sponsor grad students doing thesis work. There's only been about 11 PhD theses done about UFOs. There's room for plenty more. Then you won't report your sighting, that you won't investigate. The best witnesses are the ones least likely to report. You know, professional people in a small town? Wow.
Right.
Who needs that, you know? So lifting the laughter curtain has always been one of my goals, and I think I'm being fairly successful at that. I've only had 11 hecklers and over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. You know, you get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics, etc.
Well, and this is a subject that definitely hits home for people. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight is Stanton Friedman. And we're talking about his new book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which you can get on Amazon.com or on your website, right, which is StantonFriedman.com?
Yeah, you can get it through the website. And the big advantage of the website, really the only advantage, is that you get the books are autographed by both Kathy and myself. And you don't get that through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Well, we don't care where you get it. Just get it and read it and get ready to talk when your opportunity comes, you know.
Right, like the star map. I mean, that's always the most fascinating. I mean, if Betty had gotten to keep this book that she was a little
bit in. Well, yeah, wouldn't that be something?
That would be nice, but we have this star map, at least her memory of it now, and Marjorie Fish's amazingly genius work. So
yes,
tell us about that. I mean, that's just, it blows my mind.
The icing on the cake, in a way. Betty, under hypnosis, is reliving how she's trying to get the leader of this crew, 11-being crew, to tell her where he's from. And the understatement of the month, she says, I know you're not from around here. Well, he shows her what I can only call a hologram. It had a three-dimensional quality, a map, a model, 2 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet. She's looking up at it. There are 16 stars connected by three different kinds of lines, heavy trade routes and normal trade routes, occasional expeditions. And she asks him, well, where are you on the map? Wise guy alien says, Do you know where you are in a map?
No.
I don't know anything about astronomy. How can I tell you where we're from if you don't know where you are on a map? End of discussion. Now, you can feel a little sorry for Dr. Simon. I mean, here he's got a woman, a social worker. She and her husband are obviously sharp, bright, decent people, telling him this crazy story. And now we hear about trade routes and occasional expeditions. So he gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion. After asking her if she could remember what the map looked like, and she said yes, he gives her a post-hypnotic suggestion to draw it later on, if and only if she can remember it accurately. So she draws it at home and brings it into a session a couple of weeks later, and it appears in the book. And the only trouble is, how do you know what it means? There's no reference points. I mean, it's not the galaxy. There are 200 billion stars in a galaxy. Maybe 300 billion. Doesn't matter.
It's a terribly complicated map that she drew. I mean,
well, when it got published in the book, and it seemed hopeless. We'll never know what it means. Well, this woman named Marjorie Fish, a brilliant woman in Ohio, member of Mensa, third grade teacher at the time, as a matter of fact, decided she could do something about it. She was dubious about the story because the beings in this story are basically humanoid, two arms, two legs, a head, and a body. I mean, you would recognize they're not from around here, at least if you weren't in New York City or someplace. But she had trouble with that. She thought aliens ought to look different. But she visited Betty to get more information. Then she went back home and had the guts to do something that was quite incredible. She wound up building a total of 26 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood. The point being to see if there was a three-dimensional pattern that matched the two-dimensional one that Betty had drawn. So you build these three-dimensional models, little beads strung on nylon fish line. You got to get the right coordinates where each of those beads is relative to the sun. And then you look from all different directions, and is there a pattern that matches? She thought she'd find many. She didn't find any. And kept redoing, and one of her big models had 250-some stars in it. She gradually zeroed in on the fact that she started eliminating stars. Stars are more different than people. They're big, they're small, they're old, they're new, they're hot, they're cold, they've got close companions, they vary in their energy output. A lot of variation between stars. It's nice to look at
the sky. Giants, blue dwarves, all that.
What?
Red giants, blue dwarves.
Yeah, I mean, they're very variable. Anyway, she got a new catalog of the distance data. Wilhelm Gliese had published a new catalog. The hard part was the distance data. You see, an astronomer doesn't need to know how far a star is to look at it. You need two angles, you know, like vertical and horizontal, and where they meet, that's where you aim your star, your telescope. And whether it's 20 light years away or 40 light years away doesn't matter. But if you're trying to build a model, you need to know.
Right.
When she rebuilt one of the models with this latest Wilhelm Gliese data, there was the pattern. One and only one pattern that matched angle for angle, line length for line length, what Betty had drawn. It was quite a day for Marjorie. And I had been asked to see if I could help Marjorie by the head of APRO. Coral Lorenzen had called me. Marjorie wanted to talk to a scientist that she could share data with, and Coral picked me, and so I arranged to see Marjorie in Ohio, and I was with her when she made her presentation to J. Allen Hynek in Chicago at Adler Planetarium, and helped explain her work at a Mutual UFO Network symposium in Akron, Ohio. It's in the early 70s. And the remarkable thing is, when you look at the facts, is that, A, every star that was in the pattern was the right kind for planets and life. Only 5% of the stars in the local neighborhood are sun-like, not too hot, not too cold, etc. That's the first thing. Secondly, all of these stars are in a plane. Think of a big, thin pizza with slices of pepperoni on it, thin slices,
right,
as opposed to a big loaf of raisin bread with the raisins all over the place. And this matters because travel is much easier if you're all in the same plane. All the planets in the solar system, for example, are basically in a plane, rather than helter-skelter, hither, thither, and yon. And, of course, it's the base stars that are really unique. she made a discovery nobody else knew, that the base stars in this pattern are Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli, constellation of Reticulum, the net, that means, Southern Sky constellation. But these two stars are the closest to each other pair of sun-like stars in our entire local neighborhood. In other words, the sun is out in the boonies here. The next star over from the sun, which isn't a sun-like star as it happens, is 4.3 light years away. These two stars are only 39 light years from here, 39.2, but from each other, they're only an eighth of a light year apart. In other words, they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. We're out in the boonies. These guys got next-door neighbors. And, oh, yes, it just so happens that they're a billion years older than the sun. And from a planet around one looking over at the other, it's visible all day long for most parts of the planet. And so you'd expect there'd be a heck of a lot more incentive to develop interstellar travel when you got a neighbor next door as opposed to, you know, over in the next country.
Right.
And because of basically a Friedman's law, the technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. I was working on fusion propulsion systems for deep space travel in the early 1960s. And every civilization, incidentally, out there is going to know about fusion because that's the process that produces the energy in the stars, all the stars. We only found out that in 1938, I might add. They used to think that the systems weren't very old because you figure out how much gas you'd burn in how much time, and stars don't last very long, a few million years maybe. Well, if you use nuclear fusion, then you start talking billions of years.
Wow.
And so it's a very exciting story. I wrote the first paper about it. It was in Saga magazine. Convinced Terence Dickinson, then editor of Astronomy magazine, who I'd met him before, to do an article in Astronomy. It got more reaction than anything they'd ever published before or since. They published 11 more letters that year, put out a 32-page full-color booklet. They sold 10,000 copies immediately, which is unheard of for an astronomical publication.
Mm.
And then Carl Sagan's lawyer threatened to sue them because his name was on the front, along with the names of the other contributors in these letters. And because I had instigated the article, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and I wound up with 18,000 copies in my garage in California. I'm all out. I sold out last year, and boy, I could sell a ton of them this year with Captured coming out. But the point is, it stirred a great deal of interest, and I was recently talking to Terry Dickinson, and we agreed that despite all the changes in astronomy, for example, now we have great data on distances. The European Space Agency's Hipparchos satellite made literally millions of measurements from space, very accurate data on distances. Despite all this new work, Marjorie Fish's work stands up very well.
It's remarkable.
She was, a brilliant one.
Well, have you ever run across any other evidence that points to Zeta Reticuli being the origin of, I guess, the grays?
Well, not really, no. And, of course, people say, well, have we heard any signals from Zeta Reticuli? And Seth Shostak will tell you, oh, we listened to that 10 years ago, and we didn't hear anything. Yeah. It's one of the silliest aspects, and there are several, about the whole SETI program. Silly effort to investigate, S-E-T-I.
Right, right.
It assumes the aliens are stuck at our level of technology. We can figure out what frequencies to tune in on and what the scheme will be for transmission of signals from outer space. Think about this. Let me tell you a true story. In 1938... the Germans, a German general heard that the British were building these 200-plus foot-tall towers with crossbars on them. And the German general says, look, we're working on radar in secret. That's what they must be doing. We have to find out the characteristics of their radar, because when we attack, and attack we will, we better be able to counter the radar, you know, do all kinds of electronic countermeasures.
Right.
So they flew the Graf Zeppelin along the English Channel, off the coast of Britain, listening at 70 miles an hour, slow Zeppelin, listening with their best equipment for the radar signals. They didn't find anything. They did it a second time. That resulted in an international incident because they wound up flying a bit over England, and, oh, you can't do that. Well, we're just blown off course by the wind. Where have I heard that song before? But then they didn't get anything, and they never realized that the Brits did indeed use radar, but they used a frequency 10 times higher or lower, I forget which, than the Germans were using. Well, here you have two civilizations separated by a few hundred miles with very great commonality in their education. They had each, you know, went to school, gone to school in the other's countries, and there were no mysteries, German science, English science, etc. And they couldn't get the frequency right. Now, here we are sitting on Earth, a not very advanced civilization, and we're going to be able to correctly predict the signals from an extraterrestrial civilization? I mean, it makes no sense at all. In addition, people said, well, we looked for planets. Yeah, we're not able to see Earth-like planets at this time. Now, in the next 20 years, there are a couple of new special satellites that are going to go up that will be able to spot Earth-like planets throughout our local neighborhood. But the fact that we haven't so far is pretty ridiculous. We aren't able to. The sophistication of our measuring techniques is simply not good enough. So, no, we don't have any other evidence that I'm aware of. I mean, there are all kinds of groups on the Internet, the Zetans and so forth, who talk about Zeta Reticuli, but isn't it interesting? The Hill case took place in 1961. You certainly won't see anything mentioning reticulans until after I'd published the work about Marjorie Fish's work.
Well, do you include, like, mention of abductions in your lectures?
Oh, yeah. I talk about the Hill case. I've been talking about that for many years. I do cover most of my evidence is, well, the five large-scale scientific studies that I deal with that, after each one, I show a slide, tell what's in it, and I ask how many people have read this. And I'm lucky if it's 1 or 2% of for any of them.
Wow.
So I talk about them. I talk about the Hill case. I talk about physical trace cases. Ted Phillips has over 4,000 cases where physical changes were found in the dirt. These aren't crop circles now.
See, Stan, this is what blows my mind is why. How can we still have skeptics? There's people in my own family who I can't
look,
convince.
There are people who refuse to believe the Earth is round. I can't account. I look upon the world as everything has a Gaussian curve, you know, the picture, the bell-shaped curve. There's a certain percentage of people who say, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. They can't possibly be real. We have a certain percentage of people who say, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. They're here to save us, and I'm going to be saved. I'm not trying to reach either of those groups because they both say, don't bother me with the facts. Hey, I'm a nuclear physicist. Facts are what matter. You got to have a big gray basket because there are questions you can't answer. I don't have enough data.
Right.
But, you know, well, I did a debate. A lot of people saw me on the Larry King show. July 13th.
Yeah, with Michael Shermer.
Yeah, well, Shermer, I had a number of people email, why didn't you just punch him out, Stan? That's not my style, of course. But I got my revenge because we debated on Coast to Coast Radio on August the 1st for 3 hours, 3 to 6 a.m. my time, frankly. And then the audience voted, and I got 80% of the vote. So, well, it was a crazy thing. Preston, he hadn't done any homework before the Larry King show, and he didn't do any after it. You'd think he would have checked me out on the web. You know, I've got a website, and there's a lot of stuff on it, and I come on pretty strong. There's my articles like Government UFO Lies, there's my challenge to SETI, the UFO Why questions. I mean, I'm not an apologist ufologist.
I think people have to make a distinction between a skeptic and a debunker.
Yeah, he was definitely a debunker or a denier, a dynamic denier, a dedicated denier, whatever you want to call it. But it was clear that he knew nothing at all about the subject. And it's one of the things that aggravates me. When you get people, I did a debate with Seth Shostak on there. He did a little better. I got 57% of the vote, and he got 33, and the other 10 said, I don't know who won. But they keep saying there is no evidence. And then you look for in vain for references to any of these five large-scale scientific studies, and there aren't any. Matter of fact, Seth and I each gave three lectures on the last westward cruise of the Queen Elizabeth II back 4 years ago, I guess. And in the course of my lecture, we each attended the other's lecture. We were cordial to each other. And I asked who's read this, that, and the other thing, and he hadn't raised his hand any of the time. When we finally did a debate on Costa...
Hello, are you there? Sorry about that. We had a brief interruption, but we're back. You're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal with Preston Dennis, and our guest tonight is Stanton Friedman. And sorry about that, Stan.
I thought the aliens were giving me trouble, but it was probably the noisy negativists, huh?
Right. MJ-12, and there's been recent developments with that and some controversy. Oh, gee.
One good controversy to another. I will say this, that in my book, Top Secret Magic, especially the second edition, which came out in 2005, I deal with, in a new afterword, 5,000 words, deal with all the objections raised by the noisy negativists. Now, I am satisfied that the Eisenhower briefing document, the Truman Forrestal memo, and the Cutler Twining memo are genuine, and the SOM 101, Special Operating Manual 1.01, is also genuine, maybe a tenth of a percent less surety, if you will. And that there's a whole bunch more that are phony, the Tim Cooper documents and so forth. And if they look on my website, they'll see a paper update on Majestic 12 in which I compare some of the purported Tim Cooper MJ-12 documents with original documents that I found in books. And you can see the phony ones are emulations of the real ones. That is, they're retyped, few changes made, the handwritten material is Xeroxed or scanned either way, put together to make a phony document. If you see them side by side and they're in my article, you can clearly see, oh, I see, they took this real document and there are mistakes in them. It's a long story, but now the other new development, Dr. Heisler, pointed out that he had a woman named Dr. Chastity run a new kind of analysis of text to see whether the MJ-12 documents were real. You get articles, real documents you know to be genuine, that is written by the author whose name is on it, and you compare. It's things like sentence structure and punctuation and a whole bunch of other things, and nothing to do with content as such. And he made a big deal and a big announcement that we have shown that the MJ-12 documents are fraudulent, and therefore, in effect, he was saying Roswell didn't happen. Well, in the first place, she didn't check the Eisenhower briefing document. She didn't check the Cutler-Twining memo. She did look at the Truman-Forrestal memo, but I have consistently said, and I do in Top Secret Magic, that I don't think it was written by President Truman. I talked to a guy who worked for him the whole time he was in the White House who said 90% of what a president signs is prepared by other people, and the two people that I suggest one or the other did it was Secretary Forrestal, who it was addressed to, or Van Bush, who's mentioned in the text. And I asked this guy, and he said, oh, yeah, of course, they would have trusted those two people. So the new evidence tells us nothing except that there's a bunch of phony documents out there which have nothing to do with whether or not the original documents are genuine. And I should add, it's standard intelligence agency technique. If good stuff gets out, you put out all kinds of garbage. You flood the market with garbage, and hopefully the evil gets rubbed off on the original stuff, and you can relax and say, we fooled them again, you see?
Right.
And disinformation is what we're talking about, is what I mean, and that's standard government policy.
Well, I mean, even if these documents aren't real, I mean, your research into the members of this supposed group clearly points to a lot going on, like Donald Menzel, for one thing.
Well, yeah, my findings on Menzel, which were what made me take this document seriously. I mean, here we have a document. There's two Army, two Navy, two Air Force, five scientists, and the Secretary of Defense. And one of the scientists is Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, who'd written three anti-UFO books. I mean, the document dates back to 47 or 52 for when these guys are listed. And here's Menzel, who wrote three anti-UFO books, taught astronomy at Harvard. Now, you do not need a high-level security clearance, presumably, to teach astronomy at Harvard. All these other guys we know from what work they did, and especially during World War II and subsequently, had high-level security clearances. So what the heck's Menzel doing here? I didn't like him when he was alive. But I had to get permission from three different people to see his papers at Harvard. All these guys were dead when we got the original Eisenhower briefing document. Very convenient, some people would say. The last one died just a few months beforehand. The first one born was the last one to die, which is rather amazing. He was in his 90s, Dr. Hunsicker. Anyway, I got permission from three different people to look at Menzel's papers and discovered to my total amazement and that of everybody else in ufology that he led a double life. He wrote to Jack Kennedy, who was on the Board of Overseers at Harvard before he became president, that he, Menzel, had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency. You know, NSA never says anything, no such agency, those guys who listen in on everything. He wrote to Kennedy that he had a longer continuous association, he, Menzel, with the NSA of anybody in the country with the NSA and its Navy predecessor. It turns out that he also stated in his unpublished autobiography that he had a top-secret ultra-clearance with the CIA, that he did classified work for 30 different companies, that he was a cryptographer and taught courses in cryptography. In short, a double life. Nobody knew this about him, and I say that because even when there was a major article in his honor after his death in Sky and Telescope, there's no mention of this work. He was head of communications unit number one of the Naval Reserve. Nobody knew that either. And so it suddenly made it possible. And he also wrote science fiction, I better add. And I found a few people who knew about his government involvement in a lot of circles. And even when there was a special issue of Sky and Telescope in honor of the 100th anniversary of his birth, there's no mention of these military intelligence activities. So it was a total surprise. Now, some people say, how could somebody live a double life? Let me point to Burgess, Philby, and McLean. Three Englishmen who worked in the military intelligence in England and were Russian spies. Now, that's living a double life.
Right.
You got to be very careful how you behave so nobody will know what you're doing on the side, so to speak. So Menzel was a giant surprise. Three of the directors of Central Intelligence were part of this group of MJ-12. Outstanding group, and none of them were elected officials. Truman was smart. And, you know, there's been a new development, Brad Sparks of California, disdainful in his MUFON conference paper given in early August, is disdainful of MJ-12, and he tries to dismiss the Cutler Twining memo by saying, well, it's an emulation of another memo which I had found The only reason he says that is the last sentence in both is similar. If you agree with the information, there's no need for you to respond, is basically what it says. And I found out from, these are memos to Twining, that from Twining's aide and his pilot, and I met with him, got his flight log, could prove that as the Eisenhower briefing document says, he did go to New Mexico on July 7th. But I found out that this phrase, your concurrence in these conclusions, is assumed. It was a standard phrase to mean, in response to a classified document, you don't have to respond. We'll assume you understand what's going on here, and that saves paper pushing. So that's the only sentence that's alike. That proves legitimacy, not that it was an emulation. And, you know, there are other equally invalid arguments made. Brad is upset because where it talks about symbols being seen, it doesn't say Menzel investigated this. Well, it says C attachment E. He leaves that out in his discussion. Presumably, that's where he would say who did what for whom, why, and how. It's really crazy. Another argument is it says the site, the crash site, was approximately 75 miles northwest of Roswell. Oh, but if you go by the roads and check it out and use GPS and so forth, it's 102 miles. Well, it says approximately. Right. What difference did it make? He also leaves out the fact that there was an airstrip out near there from near the gas pipeline, which was used to fly small planes out there. That's only 62 miles. So approximately 75 miles is a very good number. If he said exactly, that would be another story. Then it would be a mistake and clearly false. So I listened to all the objections. I can't find any that stand up. Now, admittedly, there are people who say, look, saucers aren't real, therefore Roswell didn't happen, and therefore if Roswell didn't happen, the MJ-12 documents are phony, and we can forget all this stuff about flying saucers and go on about our business.
Maybe they'll go away.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't think they're going to go away, and that leads me to my pretty much last question, because we've only got like a few minutes left, is what do you think is the future of UFO research and UFO activity on our planet? Do you think this cover-up is ever going to end? It's like an open conspiracy now. Everyone believes the government is hiding something already.
Well, I think you're right, and I'm very optimistic for a couple of reasons. One is the Chicago Tribune article on January 1st of this year, Above the Fold. It was an article about the sightings at O'Hare Airport, and the fancy document, 152 pages, is now out. But this was a case that occurred in 2006, November 7th. A bunch of United Airlines employees see this round thing sitting above the United Airlines terminal under 1,900 feet. That's where the clouds were. And that took off, almost straight up and drilled a hole in the clouds.
Right.
The important thing was that the article got more hits on their website, over a million, than any other article they had ever published. And it led the list for 4 days, which has never happened before. And the journalist, John Hilkovich, got calls from all over the world from serious people wanting to interview him, media stuff. This, too, had never happened, and the Trib itself called attention to this incredible outburst of interest. And, of course, they paid attention because newspapers are fighting for circulation. And I believe when the word got out, that led to greater coverage of, Fife Symington's announcement that he had seen the Phoenix Lights as a pilot and so forth. Who cares what a former governor sees? Well, that got a lot of coverage. The story of two pilots who saw this huge thing south of England, the Channel Islands. Two pilots, this thing was about a mile long, they estimated. That got a lot of coverage. The fact that the French and then the Ministry of Defense in England put a lot of stuff on their websites, that got incredible coverage. And maybe that's why this strange story of the city of Fredericton, New Brunswick, calling August 27th Stanton Friedman Day, got so much publicity. I couldn't believe it. All over the place.
People
I did more media interviews than I'd done any other time since the 50th anniversary of Roswell. I think maybe maybe some media group will have guts enough to blow the lid off the cosmic Watergate the way the Washington Post did on the political Watergate. Yes, it takes money, it takes effort, it takes time, but there's an awful lot of documents out there. People get a real chuckle when I show my blacked-out documents from the CIA or the whited-out documents from the NSA. They're not covering anything up. Well, you can't read anything but one sentence on each page of 156 pages of UFO documents. I think we're headed in the right direction. In other words, I'm very much an optimist about breaking through on this one. Now, I should stress, I don't want technical data out on the table. You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They read the newspapers. They listen to your radio program, too. So I don't think anything that would help somebody build a better flying saucer to use to deliver weapons should be put out where the Osamas of the world can get at it.
Right, right.
So I'm still an optimist.
Well, it's great to hear. Stanton, that's our time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. www.stantonfriedman.com at your service.
All right.
Thanks, Preston.
Thank you. All right, everyone, that's our show tonight. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. Our guest tonight has been Stanton Friedman, author of the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which you can get at his website, stantonfriedman.com, on amazon.com. And I hope you can join us next week. We're moving to Saturday, actually, at a new time, from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific time. And our guest will be Pamela Kinney. And she's going to be talking about Haunted Richmond, Ghosts in Virginia. So thank you, and have a great evening.